Sunday, July 22nd at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents artist, author, and cultural activist Nana Camille Yarbrough. Join us as we discuss moments in Nana Camille's career and collaborations. That's Sunday, July 22nd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. We've come a long, long way together.
I want a little sugar in my bowl. I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is writer, actress, composer, and social commentator, Nana Camille Yarbrough. This is going to be a very information-packed program, so you don't want to miss this. But before we get into the program, I'd like to express the heartbreaking news that three producers have resigned: J. Smooth, Rebel Diaz, and Jeannie Hopper. J. Smooth and Jeannie Hopper were longtime programmers on this air. The reason that they had to step down is regrettable. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar. My
elders, we see you walking down the street with work worn hands and with weary feet. We hear your wisdom lift a child or a crowd from confusion up to stand and proud. You've carried us, so yes, you still inspire, lifting us higher, higher, higher and higher. And every time we think of what you've come through, sweet elders, we're so very proud. Elders, we're so proud of you. Elders, we're so proud, one more time, of you. If you couldn't see a better day, you work so we would. You work for something you could pass along, some kind of wisdom that would make us strong. Now time goes by and you are elder old. yet your joyous pains and victories have never been told. So we hope you remember for the rest of your days that we love you and will forever, forever sing your praise. Elders, we're so proud. Elders, elders, we're so proud, so, so, so proud of you. For those times when you had to bow to make way for us to stand, for those times when all you could do was put it in God's hands, for those times when you said yes and sacrificed when you wanted to say no, for those times when you stood them when the world told you take low, for those times you laughed in public and went home and cried, for those times when you lived and worked and loved when it seemed the whole world wished you had died. Oh, elders, oh. Those times when you took less so we could take more, for those times when you told us keep yourself clean, learn even though you're poor, for dancing your dances and shouting your shouts, for keeping them and caring what they were all about, for loving your children, for sending them to church and school, for teaching them the old time ways, the old time rules, for surviving and whatever you have to do. Every time we think of what you've come through, we have to say, elders, elders, we're so proud. Elders, we're so proud of you.
Walking down the street, come on, come on. I see you all, we see you walking. Yeah, some. Sometimes you got a stick, sometimes you got a cane, but you just making it. You making it on. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Elvis. Don't think we don't know. Don't think we're not grateful. We're grateful to you. Thank you, Elvis. You're the strong ones. You're the ones who brought us this far. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Camille Yarbrough? Nana Camille Yarbrough.
Greetings, Nana Camille.
Yes, Joyce, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. Now, I actually heard an exchange that you had where you shared that your name is actually Nana Camille. Could you explain that, please?
Sure. I am involved in the culture of African people at home and in diaspora, and... in diaspora, and I was born and raised in Chicago. Now I live in New York City. But we have been away from our ancestral home. And during the 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a resurgence of energy, of interest in our homeland. And because I had been involved since when I was in high school in African dance and then later in theater, when I was working here in New York at City College, part of the Black Studies program there, I was informed that the department was going to Ghana, and so I took that journey to Ghana, Senegal, Ivory Coast, then later on to other countries. But I was so interested, I'm so in love with who we are as a people and our story and all of the gifts we have and how generous we are, and I've wanted since childhood to be a part of that. That allegiance or that attachment to things African has always been with me. So I was in theater, but then I began writing, and the first book I wrote was a children's book called Cornrows, and there was a book party up at Tom Feelings, who was a great artist, up at his studio.
Yes.
Carol Byer did the illustrations, so she had that connection. I didn't. I was a theater person. But there I met a great historian, great educator, John Henry Clark, who I had heard about, but I'd never seen him, and there he was at my book party.
Mm.
After that, I continued to follow and to listen to him. He had lived in Ghana with the Ga people and had an allegiance and association with the Ga people here in New York. And one day after working up at City College, I was returning home, and I lived across the street from Dr. Clark. We were both on 137th Street.
Wow.
And as I was approaching my apartment, I saw this crowd outside of Dr. Clark's building. And of course, I went over, and Professor James Small was there, and other people, a lot of people I didn't know. They were from the Ga community here in New York. And they invited me to come inside, and there was a ritual going on. Dr. Clark was being installed as their local king, their local connection to the African-American community, because they wanted to have that connection with us. And he was being installed there. He was later installed at Columbia. But by that time, the Ghanaian people who were there requested James Small to ask me if I could be in that royal family. James Small was the linguist, installed as the linguist, who held the staff of the linguist to Dr. Clark. I was installed as the queen mother to Dr. John Henry Clark here. I was later on installed in a ceremony at Columbia University, as is the tradition to have a family of royalty, of people who are dedicated to the community. And Dr. Clark was the chief Asantehene in the Asante people in Ghana, the Nana. And Dr. Clark was the king, if you will, or the chief for the Ga people here. The Ga people refer to that position as Na, that's not Nana. And so a couple of years later, I went again to Ghana, but this time I went to the Asante people in the village of Agogo, and I was installed by the Agogohene there with the Queen Mother, who is sitting there, and she was the one who dressed me and prepared me for the ritual in Agogo in Ghana. And there it's Nana. With the Asante people, it's Nana. With the Ga people, it's Na. So that's why I... claiming both of them, I would say, is Nana Camille Yarbrough. That's how that came about.
Now, you were born in the South Side of Chicago. I understand your father's from Alabama and your mother's from Chicago.
Her family came up through the Carolinas into Chicago.
What was life like there? Was that where you developed your love of storytelling and singing and dancing?
Yes. It's a many-layered story, and it has to do with what we are born with. All of us are born with gifts, certain DNA rich in great history, and some of us have stronger leanings or attachments to our people than others. I have always had it. I didn't recognize it until, well, I was really still very early. My grandmother noticed it, and she was always watching me, and she told my mother that I was an old head. I didn't know what she meant until much later in life. But my father, having come from Alabama and been raised in the church there by his mother and grandmother, who was not a preacher in the seminary sense, but during enslavement, she had been an enslaved person. And after slavery, she was called by that formerly enslaved community to come and preach to them, not preach, but to soothe them, to help them get through what they had been existing and still existing in going through in Alabama, the racism, the evilness. And so my father would go with her when she went to talk to the people and help them survive, help them heal the wounds. He told me how he would be frightened because when she went there, they would sing and talk and testify, and she would lead them in that, and sometimes she would cry and go on her knees, and he said he was afraid she would get sick or die because it was all so passionate. But she never did, and he continued to accompany her on these visits. One day in Chicago, I must have been about 4, I think, my father, having come from that area, would listen to the radio every Saturday, I believe it was, and there was a choir named the Wings Over Jordan Choir, which was in the South, and they had a radio show once a week on the weekend, and he would listen to it, and I heard that music, and I remember asking him what kind of music that was. And he told me it was our music, it's black people's music, and they call it Negro spirituals. It sort of put a pin in something. It kind of stopped me because of the sound. I couldn't understand all the words. I was very young, but there was something about it that just caught me and made me pay attention. And I think it was there that I began this association with the culture of Africa, the real culture, the deep culture that came over those terrible waters with our people. But it was later on when we were not upper middle class. We were really having a hard time. And so my family could not afford to buy me a bicycle. And because I was reading, I loved to read always, and I would read the newspapers every day. My father would bring them home, and I would read them. And I would read the Chicago Defender, which was a very powerful black newspaper at that time. And then the Times, Chicago Sun. Well, Chicago Sun and the Chicago Times decided to combine, and they wanted to build up their readership. And so they offered to young people who would sell 15 subscriptions to the new paper a brand new bicycle.
Oh, wow.
Or J.C. Higgins. So, you know, I jumped on that. I sold so many subscriptions. I got my brother a bicycle and me a bicycle.
Wow.
And it was on that bicycle, though, that there's a park in Chicago, Washington Park, which is not far from where I live. And I took off and I would ride through the park. And one day riding through the park, I heard some sounds, and it drew me to them at a field house. And there were drums, and there was a dance class going on in that field house. And they were doing what they called our dance, the dance of African people in America, was called primitive dance.
Wow.
You did it.
I remember reading that, too, and felt, oh, my God, that is unnerving. It's like they call it primitive dance.
Everything about us was primitive. You know, no culture. We were doing these magnificent movements that they were all trying to copy.
Right.
We created this great music, which was being copied, but they all referred to us as primitive. Mm. And so this primitive dance and this primitive rhythm got me. And I went home and I said, Mama, I'm going to take these classes. And she was happy because I was a very quiet child who was always listening to the radio and listening to music. And then my friends, I would go to the library and I would come back and tell them what I was reading. And they'd tell me to shut up. You're just a nigger just like us. You're always trying to be something else.
Wow.
And I said, I'm not trying to shut up. So I was at home a lot, so I came and told Mom I wanted to study dance. I was in high school.
Okay.
Yeah. I did not start early. I had to go through an awful lot, but by the time I found dance, it was like an explosion. Mama tried to teach me piano, and I was studying for a while, and I said, no, this is not it. The pressures were too great. We were living through a lot of pressure, and I needed something which spoke to my soul more directly and was explosive. And it was the dance that did that.
Can I get a witness? I wonder, can I get a witness to the shame? You newborn leaders, you weary travelers, you longtime members, you true believers, can't you hear wives moaning? Another man gone, locked in jail, not convicted, he just can't be a man. Oh, and I'm alone. Yeah, yes, alone. Oh, can't you hear widows screaming? Another man who wouldn't be a slave, shot and gone to his grave. And I'm alone. I'm alone. Oh, can't you hear? Black, stay back, lonely women weeping. Another man gone who couldn't see his own beauty, the beauty in me. And I'm alone. Can't you hear mother's cry? He was just a child trying to be, but they took my little boy away from me, and I'm alone. Yes, I'm alone. Can't you see children watching? Another man gone by war, by dope, twisted, destroyed. When he lost all hope, he was father, he was brother, he was husband, he was lover, he was son. Gone. Almost everyone. And we're alone, yes. Yes, we're alone. I feel a need to testify, to call a name. Lord, I feel a need to testify, to call a name. I wonder, can I get a witness to the shame? You newborn leaders, you longtime members, you true believers, you weary travelers, can I get a witness to the shame?
What you gonna do?
What brought you to Katherine Dunham? Because I understood you danced with her.
Yeah. I was studying them at the field house, and then they suggested that I go downtown because I was really growing and ambitious and working, and they suggested I go to another teacher. His name was Jimmy Payne, and he was downtown, which is in the white neighborhood, but it was where all of the major department stores were, State Street, and all those things were there, business area and show business area. And so I began to study there and began to dance with this dance group, the Jimmy Payne Dancers. We would do nightclubs and parties and all of that. In addition to that, I loved Latin music, so I began dancing, and I was a dancing child, and I got a couple of partners. And one day after a concert, this woman came to us, and she introduced herself, and she told us that she had been one of in the original Katherine Dunham Company. And I knew, because I'd been reading about Dunham for years and going to the library and looking at that marvelous book that was there, which had pictures of the dances in it, and seeing her in film. You know, at that time we didn't have TV. We were not usually in movies except those Cabin in the Sky movies and
right.
all of those things. So when we saw us, it was like, wow, let's go. We would pack the movie house. There's one movie, King Solomon's Mines, the first one, which made a great difference in all of our lives, all of our dances. We packed the theaters and just watched, because that was Africa, and they had real Africans in it.
Right.
And they
and African dance.
Yes, yes, and drummers, and mm-hmm. the culture. They were so dignified and gorgeous, and we would sit there, all of my little group, and we would go back again and again, but this woman came to me and my partner and said she was going to do a concert and would we be guests on that show? And we said yes. So we did the concert. Shortly after that, I received a call from her and said that Katherine Dunham's husband was coming to town and he was looking for dancers. Understand that Dunham had had the company for years, and Eartha Kitt had left. Robinson, who married Harry Belafonte, she was part of the company for years. And they'd been there for years and they had left, so he was looking for replacements. And we were asked to perform for him. And we did. My partner and I danced. I had a drummer there, and we did our dance. Actually, what was being taught and what Jimmy Payne taught was a diluted or version of Katherine Dunham. But, you know, all the teachers added their little piece here
right.
and a little piece there. So I was familiar with a lot of the movement, and so it was not that difficult for me when I did. We auditioned for Mr. John Pratt, who was Miss Dunham's husband. And it must have been a month later I received a letter from Katherine Dunham, sent to me by her secretary, Marjorie Scott, saying that Mr. Pratt had spoken to them about me and they would like for me to come and audition. And they were in Los Angeles at that time. So I flew out there and auditioned there. It was an extraordinary experience. Understand, it was a different world there. We did not see ourselves. We certainly didn't see African dance or anything that was close to African dance. There were people who were in the business, but on a certain level, we were not there. So here I was coming from that group of people who admired that company so much. It was the only such company. And there I was looking at it, and there I was in class, and I'm saying, wow, and I'm looking at Lucille Ellis, and I'm looking at Benoit, and I'm looking at Linwood and Euro and all those people who I had seen in the film and pictures of them, and there I was saying, man. And then there was Miss Dunham herself, who I was introduced to, and after class, which was not difficult for me. Some of the movements were different. As I said, other teachers had put their stamps on some of her movements, so I had to get rid of that.
Right.
After the class, I was watching. They told me just to sit down and watch. And I looked across the room, and Linwood said, okay, y'all. And he was, when he talked, he was kind of crazy. He told us, okay, we're going to rehearsal. Come on, get up, rehearse. So I'm sitting down and watching. And then they said, it's Afrique. And the drummers, who were marvelous, Julito Colasso, there were four of them. Aguabella.
Francisco Aguabella.
Francisco
yes.
Aguabella.
Uh-huh.
And there was one more Haitian was there also. So they were drumming, and I'm looking at them and listening to those marvelous rhythms. And then I look up, and the van and Ural and two other male dancers had lifted up this dunham, stood on it. It was a platform, maybe 4x4. And as she stood there, she was adjusting her headpiece, which was braids. And I'd never seen braids before. And they were like a crown of braids. And then the other ones were cascading down the side of her back and the front of her face. And I'm saying, wow. I think today people have to understand what it was like then, because we did not see our culture the way we see it today.
Right.
And I'm watching this, and I'm watching this black woman. And then they lifted that platform up on their shoulders. And Van was 6 foot something. And so it was way up, and I'm looking, and the rhythm is going. And then they start this dance with her coming out of the side of the stage, moving and coming down. And she comes down, they do this dance. And I'm saying, I was home, let's say that. It was African, and it expressed something that I had not been able to say before. But I knew then that I was in my culture. That's where I belonged. We had not long been from the South. Most of the people on the South side of Chicago had migrated from Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And they came with the wounds of having been previously their ancestors enslaved. A lot of damage had been done, and there was a lot of self-negation there. And then if you called somebody black, you were in trouble. If you called somebody African, you were in serious trouble.
Right.
If you called somebody the N-word, you were dead.
Right.
Along with talked about their mama, you were dead.
Exactly.
So being in this company, their attitudes were not perfect either, but they realized that they were in something that was unique, not only unique, but phenomenal, that was changing, touring the country with that company and going from state to state and watching the audiences, how they responded to seeing themselves with dignity. You understand, there was no shuffling and eye rolling in the Dunham Company. The movement, because she was an anthropologist, she had studied where the movements came from, what they meant,
right,
the colors, the costumes, dress you wore, the rhythms that were played with certain dances. I often look at the shows now when they say, you were going to dance a samba, and there ain't no samba being played. But there you learned where the culture, where the movement, where the dance, where all of that came from, when we did the Haitian movement, learning the songs and why there was sacrifice and what it meant was so very valuable. And the audiences, as we crossed the country, were very welcoming. But because there were not that many venues there, Dunham worked in nightclubs. And when I first went to California, they were working at a club called Ciro's, which in Hollywood was where all the stars went.
Exactly.
But she had to take up all those kinds of things. And there's so many stories about that company existing. But I did not see that kind of reception of audiences to our culture until years later on, when I was acting in To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. And we traveled across the country. I think 54, 56 cities we went to. And the audiences were marvelous. They were hungry, you understand. They were hungry for our culture. They were hungry to see themselves portrayed with dignity and with truth. It was during the Black is Beautiful time. And so going to the campuses where the young people received us like it was heaven, so different from what they had before. But that play is quite magnificent, and it's important to us what is said in that play. But the audiences would come from miles around. Churches would come. All kinds of people would be there. Getting their response was magnificent.
Well, you mentioned the play Young, Gifted, and Black. At what point did you transition to being an actress?
Because I was interested in story. I was interested in our people. And I saw so much that needed to be said, that needed to be shared, so that we can say, oh, I went through that too, and I overcame it, or I went past it, or I created this. And also, I wanted to, how can I say it, being in New York, no, it started before that, but being in New York, getting into the struggle to get work, to audition, to
right,
discover who you are, to maintain yourself, and then being told, who do you think you are? You just the B word, only they didn't say it as much then as they say it now. And trying, as a woman, I felt so much pressure. It's not just me, it's all of us, to go with the flow, to be handled, to be disrespected, and to like it.
Yes.
And that bothered me. So I ended up in the hospital several times with ulcers. And I said, oh, no, it's not that. But I've also found that in New York, you had to sing, you had to dance, you had to act, you had to do cartwheels, you had to do karaoke, you had to do many things.
Right.
You had to be well trained. And so when I came, as a matter of fact, the first show I was in was called Kwamina, and it was a pseudo-African show, and the choreographer, Agnes DeMille from Hollywood, I used to go to the films and see her dance work in all these Hollywood films, and here she was choreographing the show, and I'm saying, wow, Agnes DeMille, that's something, but it was racist. Anyway, at any rate, I almost got fired from that show. But I decided that I wanted to act before that, and I studied a bit, but some things came naturally. I was very good at it, and I wanted to understudy that part, but Dr. Gloria Ben Scott was given that part. I was giving a solo dance, but I didn't want to dance because I had been sick, and I said, I want to act. I really don't want to dance. It was something that was said by DeMille in that company. When we auditioned, she selected Charles Moore.
The dancer.
Me, yeah. Louis Johnson, Barbara Antier.
Oh, wow.
The brother who did Benson, what's his name?
Robert Guillaume.
Yeah, Robert Guillaume.
Uh-huh.
And several others.
Wow.
Were all in that play. And what she said was that she hired Charles Moore and me and Dr. Ben Scott because we had been in the Dunham Company. And we knew that we had the kind of technique that is adaptable. We could do anything. Although I was not really very well versed in ballet. I'd studied ballet, but that was not my thing. My thing was the Dunham dance, the combination of diasporic African dance. But because of that training in the Dunham Company, we were hired in many places. All they had to hear, you were a Dunham dancer. Okay, come in. However, at that point, I began taking acting classes, which were very interesting also. Many reasons.
You want to name a couple of those reasons?
Well, what artists have to do, and it's even, I think, more serious today. Thousands of young people come to New York to get into theater. I was blessed having had that Dunham experience and then came here and auditioned for Kwamina and was accepted in that company. But still, things happened. Rex Ingram, he was in those old films, The Cabin in the Sky. He was an actor, but he had the misfortune of being accused of taking a white woman across state line. You know, they were a couple. And then he was accused of other things and just given a hard time. He may have spent some time in prison, but he was the chief in the play Kwamina. There was a lot of turmoil in the play between the director, the choreographer, the producer. The play was about this African man who had gone to England and got his white woman and came back to Africa. And she came back and they eventually got together. It was very interesting. They never saw them touch in the play. As a matter of fact, when they were walking towards one another, the curtain was closing, closing, closing. And just as they reached together, the curtain closed. They wouldn't show it on Broadway stage at that point. That was 61, I think it was, 62. And there was so much fighting going on between the composer and the producer, and the producer is married to the lead, Sally Ann Howells was her name. Getting back to Rex Ingram.
Right.
they were fighting so much, and we were called on the stage, ready to perform, and we would stand there as they cut up and carried on. And Rex Ingram, an elder to be respected, stepped out and criticized them for doing this. The rest of the cast was aghast. They, he shouldn't say anything. Why are you talking? You know who you're talking to? And he said, we come to rehearsal and you have us wait while you're arguing. So they stopped. They couldn't believe that this was happening. So we were dismissed to come back at a certain time. When we came back, they had told him that he had to apologize.
Oh, no.
Yes, they did. And all of us were standing on the stage, and some people said, well, you know he was doing this, and that's why they put him in jail, that's why he's a white woman, And I'm just saying that had nothing to do with what is happening here on the stage at this time.
Right.
And it infuriated me that they tried to break him like that, and you have to apologize to us. And they sat in the audience, these crazy people who were fighting among themselves and disrespecting everybody. I stood there. I felt so bad. He had a pipe in his mouth. And he kept trying to light it, and he wasn't supposed to do that on stage. And I remember I went over to him, and I helped him light his pipe. And I'm saying, you shouldn't be doing this to this man. And I wanted to let him know that everybody was not against him and that some people were for him, although a lot of people were scared they lose their jobs if they said something. And that's a little bit of the part of me that has always gotten me into trouble, gotten me fired. And he stood up and he tried to say, I'm sorry, but he couldn't quite say it.
Sure.
And they never forgave him for that. I'm saying that every day there was racism.
Yeah.
Things that we were asked to do, which were degrading. Get out on the floor and play dice in the African village.
Wow. There is no dice in the African village.
Not like that. And they were this miscegenation.
Right.
It was referred to about the brother who was the son of the chief and the white woman.
Right.
A lot of things. That was just in that play. But other than that, I wanted to act, and I started taking some acting classes and auditioning. And eventually, you get the hang of auditioning. I got so I knew how to do it, and I would do it well. But I had worked up in the Poconos doing some singing up there. And it's quite something to find your way in New York, in theater. I did not want to dance anymore. I wanted to act and eventually write. And that's how I got to those two creative places.
Your acting also led you to a role in Shaft. Now, how'd you wind up in there?
It was around 1969, 71 that things began very, very uplifting for our people. The civil rights movement had opened doors for us. In order to placate us, in order for us to not to be so angry, the effort was made to create dance companies. That's when they were funded. All the acting theaters got funding. And that was as a result of our protest that we would not be discriminated against and that we would not be able to not see ourselves on Broadway, good, dignified plays. The whole movement of our people created a movement in theater. And that's how all those theater companies came into being, and the dance companies came into being on flatback trucks that would be in the neighborhood. And then down at Joe Papp's theater, I started acting down there. I did three plays down there, I think it was. And Gordon Watkins was an actor, producer, director, brother, who had done a CBS special, and I was in his special. And as a result of that association, when they were auditioning for Shaft, my name was placed in, and they had seen me in other things. And so they said, okay, but it was just a little role. I have to say it was larger than what came out finally on the screen. There were four scenes that I was in that I did.
Uh-huh.
But when it came out, there were only, I think, two scenes in it, and it didn't make much sense to me. So I don't tell people that I did Shaft.
But I have to tell you, I felt great when I saw you in it. It's like, oh my gosh,
oh, really?
This is not a Camille.
Roundtree, I must say I was nervous one day, and I was his sister, see. So when he brought the guy, they were, you know, he was running away because they had this great fight, and they came to Shaft's sister's apartment. And so I was his sister, and I let him in.
Right.
And then I had two children, and I told him at one time, you won't do that in this apartment. You won't, not here, or something like that. But the next morning, when the newspapers came out, they wanted to read what the reports were of what had happened, the shootout that they had had the night before. And so I was at the table talking, and then at one point, because it was Richard Roundtree, I served him coffee, and I was holding this cup of coffee in my hand, and I was trembling, and it began to shake on the saucer.
Oh.
And I remember the director looked at me, and he said, okay, just relax, and he put something, some water or something, into the cup, because really we were faking drinking coffee. I'll never forget that. It taught me a lot of lessons. But there were other scenes in it, and that's what I want it to be, so I don't tell people anything about me being in film. But acting, I loved. I said I can tell stories here.
Janet, we must learn.
worry is bad. Not to want to know it is worse. But to pass on ignorance to someone is like, it's like passing on a curse. And it will curse your father, curse your mother, curse your sister, curse your brother. And every time you come close to one another, it will be there in between to separate and instigate. We must learn and tell our story. We must learn and tell our story for ourselves. No one else can learn and tell it for us. We must learn and tell our story for ourselves. Oh, don't hold back now and don't dilute it. Let the story come out free and whole. No one can deny, demean, or dilute it when we learn and tell our story soul to soul. Oh, tell it, Lord. Tell it now. All the peoples of the world. Learn and tell the family story. It's natural for humans to do. I don't know if other creatures learn and tell their stories, but I suspect somehow, some way they do too. All the peoples of the world tell about their homeland. Tell their children what the Creator and ancestors have done. What they envisioned, inspired, developed. The great battles they fought. The great victories they won. Then their children and can clearly see who and what they are, what their contribution should be. That's why all the peoples of the world learn and tell their story. That's how they pass on their legacy. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's how they pass on their legacy. For people who don't know and tell their family story are doomed to extinction. To a life of illusion, confusion, and collusion. Doomed to a life of playing bit parts in the fantasies of others. For your family story is that emotional anchor that keeps you from drifting. It's like the intellectual compass that points the way to go. The family story is like that spiritual engine that holds the power. That takes you forward, that takes you forward, that tells our story. We are perception changers, we are rearrangers, we are mind evolvers, we are problem solvers, we are beast eaters, we are soul excreters, we are void fillers, we are file spillers, we are thought formers, plan formers, power orchestrators, and tongue translators. We are keeping on keepers. We are reaping on reapers. We are corrupt stoppers and covered droppers. We are polluter polluters, slaves and looters, rip off rippers, strung out drippers, booty smashers, Oreo threshers, kindness of race, goods of race. We are life force sharers. We are greed rewearers. We are cosmos lookers. We are iron pot cookers. We are the mothers and fathers of humanity. Shout and tell your brother, fax and tell your father, email and tell your mother. Tell it to the world, the north, east, south, and west. But tell it to the ones that you love the best. Now, tell it to the good folk, you know, and tell it to the bad. Make the good folk happy, make the bad folks sad. Tell it to our young, yeah, tell it to our old. Cause everyone grows when our family story.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar Mabel is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is writer, actress, composer, and social commentator Nana Camille Yarborough. What you're listening to in the background is Tell It. That's from the 2003 Maat Music release, Camille Yarborough's Ancestor House. Camille Yarborough is the writer and vocalist. Sharif Hobley on guitar, James Simmons on congas and percussion, Michael Ulmer on keyboards, Trevor Allen on bass, and Michael Wimberly on drums. Before that, we heard Can I Get a Witness, Camille Yarborough, from The Iron Pot Cooker, her 1975 debut release as a leader on Vanguard Records. Camille Yarborough's the writer and vocalist, Linda Twine on clavinet, Leopoldo Fleming on conga and percussion, James Benjamin on bass, and Jimmy Johnson on drums. Before that, we heard another selection from the Iron Pot Cooker, Elders. And before that, we heard our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams and more from Nana Camille Yarborough. And once again, we tip our hat and bid very sad farewell for producers Jay Smooth, Rebel Diaz, and Jeannie Hopper. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Before we go into the telling of the story, we must do something to open the way. We must do that which opens the way, using the water and the word. The water and the word for a libation here. So, first we thank the mighty one. We thank the one that made us all. That gave us our first dignity as the parents of humanity. Ashe, 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 yow, yow, ashe, yow. Thank you, Creator. Thank you. Thank you for giving life and sustaining life and for giving us all that is beautiful, all that teaches, all that grows. Thank you. And then we thank those great ones, those strong ones, those ingenious ones, those tenacious ones, those who loved us more than they loved themselves, those who brought us this far. Yes, they loved us more than they loved themselves. They loved us more than they loved themselves. Oh, yes. Ancestors, we're the sweet fruit. You are the tree. Without your ancient seed, where would we be? Ancestors, thank you. Thank you, ancestors. We're the sweet fruit. You are the tree, ancestors. Without your deep, deep root, where would we be? Ancestors, thank you. Thank you, ancestors. We're the sweet fruit. You are the tree. Without your bracing bark, without your surging soul, without your strong, strong branches, where? First, thank my immediate family, those whose names I remember, those whose names I don't even know, but I felt their strength. I must thank first my great-grandmother, Rebecca, who was an enslaved person here in this land, and who, after the Civil War, traveled, was called to travel across Alabama by the people of that community. Those formerly enslaved, who called her to help them heal, to help them see their way through. Yes, they all felt the need for that old strength. And she traveled. Great-grandma Rebecca traveled sometimes in a carriage, sometimes on foot. She walked the roads of Alabama with her hand on the head and the shoulders of my grandfather, who traveled with her to help sustain our people, to soothe their pain, to ease their hurt, to help them raise their vision. Thank you, great grandma Rebecca. Thank you, Grandma Debbie. And all of us have someone in our family who helped us with a word or an action, helped us come this far. And let us thank those who love.
loved us more than they love themselves. Let us thank Harriet Tubman. Oh, yes. Let us thank Nat Turner. Let us thank Denmark Vesey. Let us thank Paul Robeson coming closer. Let us thank going back to Nanny. Let us thank Volkmann. Let us thank all those people who fought to liberate, to strengthen us all through the ages. Let us thank Dr. King. Let us thank Fannie Lou Hamer. Let us thank Nina Simone. Let us thank all of those who went before, because we are they.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for July 22nd. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's guest is Nana Camille Yarborough. She has no immediate area shows, but we'll let you know when she has something going on in the future. And before we get to our listings, a quick reminder that WBAI Radio has a mini-summer fun drive going on and needs your help. Subscribing to the station as a sustaining member, which they call BAI Buddies, with a monthly pledge is particularly helpful, because it gives the station a very reliable and consistent source of funding. It's quick and easy, and you can stop payments at any time. Details are on the station website, and we've got that linked at our site and our blog. We start with Jake McGinsky's documentary film, Milford Gray's Full Mantis, which has a run at Metrograph in Manhattan. There's a review on our blog, and you can revisit our show with McGinsky and Graves for more details. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smoke in a continuing Monday night series on July 23rd and 30th. Drummer Bobby Sanabria is at Co-op City in the Bronx on July 24th for a free outdoor concert, and that's part of the Jazzmobile series. Bassist Reggie Workman is at Grant's Tomb for a free outdoor concert on the 25th. That's also part of Jazzmobile. Guitarist Nels Klein is at The Stone with Double Double Trouble on the 25th. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from the 26th through the 29th. Trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah leads the Diaspora Ensemble at Harlem's Greater Calvary Baptist Church on the 27th. Trumpeter Freddie Hendricks is at the Blue Note for a late set on the 27th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns as a Saturday night series with late sets at Smoke on the 28th and August 4th. Looking a little further ahead, saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin is at Dizzy's Club on the 30th, playing John Coltrane's music. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at City Winery in Manhattan on August 1st. Pianist Vijay Iyer and saxophonist Ravi Coltrane are at the Jazz Gallery on August 2nd. Pianist Billy Childs leads a quartet at the Jazz Standard from August 2nd through 5th. Saxophonist T.K. Blue is at the Amphitheater in Marcus Garvey Park on August 3rd for a free outdoor performance as part of Jazzmobile. The Sun Ra Orchestra, led by Marshall Allen, returns to Earth on the 8th at Lincoln Center's Outdoors Festival, and they'll be performing a live score to the classic Space is the Place film in a free outdoor screening. Finally, saxophonist Jane Bennett and McKeke are at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from August 8th through 9th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news, and Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. Support WBAI link on our Sugar and My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, August 5th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
I wanted to write, and my experiences in Chicago, that's when they came forward, and I began to think about telling our story. I did God's Trombones, Trumpets
right.
of the Lord, had those two names, and I was understudying Cicely Tyson in it, and she came into New York with it, and when she left, I took that role of Reverend Marian Alexander. I did the hell out of that role. It was, I loved it. I loved it.
Excellent.
And we toured outside of New York. It was Los Angeles. It was St. Louis. We went across country with it. But by that time, I'd begun writing, and I wanted to begin to do that in that play. Also, was the first time that on stage, the spirit came and got me. And I had never had that happen on the stage. It had happened in studios where I ended up out of control of myself and on the floor, and things were happening to me. As a matter of fact, the drummer who was from Brazil in the class, Kevra Donovan, asked me to come back because she was opening her museum out there and they were having a celebration. And she had written a song. She asked me to come back there and sing that song. But while I was there, I went to a class, and the teacher was Brazilian, and Mortiam, the drummer, was there as part of maybe about 8 drummers, I think. And that's the first time I experienced that, where I just was overcome, ended up on the floor, and I said, what am I doing on the floor? Because the teacher had asked me to lead the dancers across the floor because I'd been with Dunham, and he was doing the Dunham thing. I started, and then the next thing I knew, I was on the floor, and I said, what the? I don't fall. All my professional years, I never fell. And I got up, and the next thing I knew, it was like something had just grabbed my head, and I was down again. But that time, I could not move. My body was moving, but I could not control what was happening to me, and very unique things were happening. In the studio, the teacher came over to me down on the floor, and he said, welcome home, child. Because I'm a Capricorn, and because I'm trained in theater, you're supposed to keep control. So I was trying to control myself, and I couldn't. And I was just looking at him, and that's all I heard. I heard him, and I heard the drums. And then he told one of the dancers to take me into the dressing room, which she did. And I sat there saying, what is going on? What is happening to me? And then Mortiam came in, and he sat there, and he said, what did you see? I thought that what I saw was not important, so I didn't tell. And I said, I don't know. And he left. But later on, he had told Dunham, as a matter of fact, that night, because afterwards I went to the reception, and he was at the door, and he said, Ms. Dunham wants to talk to you. And I said, why? He said, because of what happened in class. So I walked upstairs. I looked at her, and I said, something happened. And she just looked at me and said, yes. And I said, I have to find out about it. I have to study, because I had been studying. And she said, no, you have to join. And I'm saying, join what? And she told me there were many people in New York who could teach me about what had happened to me. And I said, okay. And that was the end of the conversation.
So did you study? Did you join?
That's a whole nother book. No.
Okay.
What I did is I attempted to, but there were many things happening to me, which I had to understand, because that's the way I am. I have to understand stuff. I was sensing things about myself and understanding why my grandmother had called me an old head. It has to do with something you're born with. And so I went to different people who were priests and priestesses, only to discover that they could not read me, that much of what is seen is not what is. And I said, I cannot be a part of that. I will continue to study. And that's what I did. I have been part of different shrines. I have listened, and I have done things. It's interesting when people begin, you don't know them, but they come to you because they see something. and they get down and touch the floor.
Right. It's like they salute you as though there is something on
your
head.
Yeah, and I'm still learning about this. You understand?
Right.
And so I went to Lavinia Williams. Lavinia Williams was one of the first Dunham dancers. Sarah Yarbrough was her daughter. And she was teaching here at Step Studio. She was teaching at all of those places. So knowing that she had lived and was living at that time in Haiti for years, and her thing was voodoo. So I said, let me go and talk with her. And she told me I was blessed and that I had been called. And you have work to do. I did not go out trying to be saved. I did not go trying to join anything.
Right.
It came to me at different periods. That largely has been my association with the spiritual part of us, is my studying personally, my association with different people who were priests. After I was teaching at City College, and James, what was his name, was the drummer.
Cherry.
And we went over.
James Cherry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We went over to the Mart to have lunch.
125, the former Mart.
125. Yes. And I came across upstairs to get some food. And as I'm coming in, I look and I see on the chair right in front of where the food is, there's this shawl, and it's beautiful. And I'm looking at it. Then I got my food, and James and I sat down, and I started talking. I said, Ashe. And I heard this voice next to me at another table, and I looked at him. And he said, you know Ashe. And I said, well, I know. And I began to explain, as I always do, the bits and pieces. And he began to talk to me. I stopped talking when I heard him say, your father said, and he told me something that my father had said years before, only to me. There was nobody else around when my father said that to me. I said, you know my father? And he began to tell me other things about me.
So the ancestors spoke to him.
Yeah, and they sent that. They made me come there. Then James, because he wanted to, he said, tell me about myself. And that's not what it was about. And the man got up and got his food. What I'm saying is that things have come to me. People have come to me with information, with protection, with questions about themselves. And so all I can do after a while is say thank you and accept the respect, accept something that they see. I accept what is given to me, what continues to come to me.
Shout, we are family, and tell the world we are family, and show the world we are family. Take my hand, brother, we are family. You help me, I'll help you stand. We are family. It's a gift from God. We are family. We're so blessed, we are family. We're the people of Africa. We're the African family. Family home in the motherland. Family scattered across the seas. But wherever we have gone, wherever we may be, we're the people of Africa. We're the African family. Forever we are family. Forever we are family. Wherever you and I may be, we are family. We're family. There's been so much to take us apart. From today back to that tragic start that brought us here in pain and fear, far away from all we love so dearly. But every time we were
We found a way, we made a new start. Loving again and again and again. Determined to live and be together forever. We are family forever. We are family wherever you and I may be. We are family. We are family. We said can't nobody turn us round. We said even can't no grave keep our bodies down. We said keep on moving higher and higher. Remember, we don't get no ways tired. So beyond the pain and fear of slavery, across the years and miles of stormy sea, our love has had the victory. We're still the African family. Forever, we are family. Come on, say it with me. Forever, we are family. Wherever you and I may be, we are family. We are family. Now look, born in Jamaica, we are family. Born in Trinidad, Tobago, we are family. Born in St. Kitts and Nevis, we are family. Born in Cuba, we are family. Born in Zimbabwe, we are family. Born in the Congo, we are family. Born in Senegal, Ghana, Nigeria, Gambia, we are family. Born in Chicago, we are family. Born in California, Detroit, we are family. Born in Brooklyn, we are family. Born in Harlem, we are family. Forever, we are family. Forever, we are family. Wherever you and I may be, we are family. Forever. I started this with a ritual, and we have to bring it back to that. So I'm going to ask you, wherever you are, if you can stand up to give respect to our family, to the coming together, to the staying together, to the loving again of our family as a family. Stand up and put your hands together to make a C, like the symbol for that first spirit that came into its humanity in the motherland. And raise it high above your head, and get kind of a swaying groove going, right? Oh yes, to the side. You know, like the choir does in church. Keep it going. Forever. Now say what I say, and do what I say do. We're born of an old seed. From a deep root. Stretch your arms. We're part of a strong branch. Let your hands hang down. We are the sweet fruit of that African tree. Now circle your arms. Wherever we may go, circle them again now. Wherever we may be. Now the right arm to the left. I am part of you. Take the hand of the person next to you. Your left arm to the right. Take the hand of the person next to you. We are family. You should be holding hands with another African right now. I know sometimes some of us don't even look like Africans, but we're there. Go back further enough, we're there. We are family. Oh, yes. Now let their hands go and hold your African self. Love your African self. Love that spirit. Started millions of years ago and survived every everything up until this day, that strong, tenacious spirit. Love it. Forgive yourself for things you think when you weren't strong enough, when you weren't smart enough. Yes, you were. Our life starts right now when we come together as a family. Now open your arms and embrace the African next to you. Tell them you love them more than you love yourself. That's how the ancestors did. They loved us more than they loved themselves. We are family forever.
And I'm grateful for it. And that's why I write so much about ancestors and family, because that is our power.
Yes.
That's who we are. And we have to protect it and uphold it and tell our story. That's why I wrote Cornrows, because I wanted us to know that it wasn't just about fashion and looking good and paying $300 to get your hair done. It was about something. It was about a value system. And that was the story of Cornrows. Everything that I've written has been about for children's books. And when I wrote Black Dance in America, I loved it because I had to do a lot of research, and I footnoted everything that I wrote because I don't believe in telling our story without some backup.
Right.
There are too many stories. So it goes on.
And you have several stories. Well, your first, I guess, was Cornrows. Then you have Tamika and the Wisdom Rings,
Little Tree Growing in the Shade.
Yeah. And Shimmershine Queens. Yes.
Yeah, and they all are teaching value. But it came from working in the schools. I worked in public school. I worked for Jazzmobile for a while. And going into the schools where I was shocked. And that's where the Shimmershine Queens comes from, that last time I was working in the schools and the experiences there. But my albums come from Chicago. That's the inspiration for the Iron Pot Cooker.
And that's where I wanted to go next, the Iron Pot Cooker. How did that opportunity make its way to you? Because you have some really nice musicians on here, which I'd like you to talk about as well.
I was doing To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, the play acting in it. Robert Nemiroff was one of the producers. Harry Belafonte was one of the producers. Chiz Schultz, who did film for Harry Belafonte and everything else, was one of the producers, and I had been writing, and I brought some of my writing, and I'd been doing my own one-woman show with Linda Twine, great, great, great pianist, with the brother who plays congas.
Leopoldo Fleming. Who was on the recording, Iron Pot Cooker.
Yes, he was on there, too. Mm-hmm. And James Fish Benjamin played bass. Mm-hmm. And the guitarist is a famous guitarist. He had not been working with me, but on the set, the producer brought
Cornell
him in.
Dupree.
Yes, and the drummer, fabulous drummer.
Jimmy Johnson.
I had started doing my poetry. At that time, so much. You would call it open mic now. Mm-hmm. But it was so political. What was happening, somebody would say, we have to go and protest. They love But It Comes Out Mad. They love Little Sally, the super sex star. And so I was doing my show across the country at colleges, because then the black student unions were powerful, and they were bringing us onto campus across the country, speaking our truth, telling what was happening, doing our art. And it was great. Some campuses I went was invited back to over and over again. It was really great. So I went to a studio, and I taped a lot of the material. And I told Chiz Schultz about it and let him hear it. I told Robert Nemiroff about it and let him hear it. Robert Nemiroff was married to Lorraine Hansberry.
Right. You know?
And at that point, they were separated. She had passed by that time when I was doing To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. And he called and said, I'm going to send it over to Nina Simone. Why don't you send it? And he gave me an address, and I sent the 12-inch disc over to Nina Simone at that address that he gave me. And Chiz Schultz had worked, as I said, many times with Harry Belafonte. So I received a call from Nina Simone's secretary, and she said, Nina likes your work very much, and I'd like to talk with you, and then maybe we can come to do a rehearsal or something like that. And she said, I need to come and talk to you. And I was living in this little tiny apartment on 79th Street, and I said, you sure this is a little apartment? She said, yes. Later on, she told me that Nina wondered if I was a drug addict or not.
Because
of Lil Salad Super Sex Star.
Oh.
She came there to check me out to see if I was or not. That's the connection to Nina.
I understood that Chiz Schultz wrote the liner notes to the Iron Pot Cooker.
He did, yes. Because of my working in To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, which is where I met him, and was responsible in many times for hiring black people to work on the films. Not necessarily on the screen, the jobs as technicians and all of that kind of thing. Recently, when I went to Chicago to get that Lorraine Hansberry Award, he went there also because he was a producer. They had a week or a month celebrating Lorraine Hansberry, and that was one of the occasions. I told him what was happening, and he said, I will go and speak for you, which he did. I was very pleased and honored by that.
The musicians, did they come to you, or were they selected by the producer?
Mainly, I selected them.
Okay.
I went to see a show up here in Harlem. The brother is no longer with us. His name is escaping me. He was a producer of a play, and I went to see this play, and off stage there was a piano being played as background music.
And that's where Linda Twine was.
That's Linda Twine. Afterwards, I went backstage and told her that I enjoyed her music so much and that I do poetry, and would she be interested in working with me because I wanted to expand and bring in music, and she agreed to do this, and that is the best pianist I've heard. She's a great accompanist. Some people play over you,
right.
You know, and some people don't play enough.
Right.
But an accompanist knows how to be there and to make it open so you can go in any direction you want to go in. Also, she was respectful. Sometimes musicians want to tell you what to do, especially if you're female. They will try and dominate. There was none of that with her. Then the bass player, maybe Linda brought him in, but he was great.
James Benjamin.
Yes. Both of them were so easy to work with, and they brought their gifts and shared them freely. We had rehearsals and all kinds of things, and it was never a problem. Leopoldo, of course, I had heard him and seen him, and when he was free, he worked with me on a couple of occasions, and then when we did the album, I asked him to be a part of it.
And he played with
Other
Nina Simone
that,
as well, right?
Absolutely,
yes.
He sure did. And he's a pro. Professionals are different from ordinary people. They know what to do, what not to do it, when to do it, how much to do, and all of those good things. Dupree, I had not met him before. The producer, Ed Bland, brought him in, and Ed Bland brought the drummer, because the first drummer I had was a brother who at that point had only played hip-hop in the beginning of hip-hop, and he did not have the flow and the sensitivity that was needed to do my work. So I had him in the first time, and we saw that, you know, he would play everything, the same thing on every song.
Right.
So the producer, Ed Bland, so that's where Jimmy came in.
Okay.
He brought him in, and he was magnificent. You know, that's the joy of playing with musicians, when the art does not overshadow who you are or life or the story. And Linda and them were so good when I was on the stage telling these stories musically. They knew when to be subdued, when to come up, and the energy flowed between us beautifully. But I had gotten ill. I had not worked for a while, and then I received this call from Ed Bland saying that Chiz Schultz had let him hear my material, and he'd like to talk with me about it. So I said, okay. We had been doing the show for about a year or two before that happened. We were still ready. And when we got into the studio, and we just did it beautifully, and it didn't take long to record. We didn't have to do it over and over and over, nothing like that.
Nice.
Celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I should.
Fatboy Slim sampling one of your songs. Could you tell me how that came about?
sure. Sampling is a big thing in the business. People do it all the time. Most of the times we don't realize we're listening to something that was sampled from somebody else and just twisted a little bit, but they steal. One day I was sitting in my little apartment on 137th Street across the street from Dr. John Henry Clark, and I was feeling pretty whatever. And the phone rang. People from Skint Records here in New York, which is Fatboy Slim's company, told me that he had sampled one of my songs. And I said, what song are you talking about? She told me to Take Your Praise. And I didn't know what sampling was. It was only later on that I discovered that you're supposed to get permission to do that, and he did not get any permission. But I started receiving these enormous checks in the mail.
Oh.
So I didn't care if he didn't get permission. He gave me 60-40 in my favor. And I was happy. I've been happy for 20 years living off of those checks. No, he didn't get permission, and then that was the permission, the fact that I was getting paid well.
Okay.
Now, the only people I have problems with are Universal, who, when you sign a contract at the time when I was signing my first contract for the album on which that song appeared, that was my first recording. I was happy to get a recording. I had heard about people being ripped off. I read the contract, and indeed, that's what it was about, but the company had to get in on your recording. I wrote the song. I sang the song. Then Vanguard Records was producing the album, and they had to take a percentage of that, so they got 50%. So Fatboy Slim did not do me wrong. He's mad at me now because he used that song for years to open and close the shows, and he felt as if that was his song. And when other people wanted to do it, he began blocking them.
Oh.
And so Universal would call me and say, what do I think about it? And I was saying, I'm glad somebody's doing it. And then, well, he doesn't want them to do it, and da-da-da. So I said, okay, let this group do it. And I think he never forgave me for that. Anyhow, the good part is I got paid, and I'm still getting paid.
Glad to hear that he didn't stop the payments.
Oh, no, he couldn't do that.
Excellent.
We've come a long, long way together. Through the hard times and the good, I have to celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I should. You're so rare, so fine. I'm so glad you're mine. You're so rare, so fine. So glad you're mine. You make me glad I'm a woman, 'cause you're a feeling, thinking man. And anytime I know you're needing, I'm gonna please you every way I can. You're so rare, you're so what I'm feeling, with why and how I want to live. You're so rare, man, you're so fine. You know, I'm so glad you're mine. You're so very rare and so fine. I'm sure not glad you're mine. I have to praise you when you hold. When you work your way around, ain't a part of me left over that your sweet love ain't found. You make my moan turn to whisper. You make my whisper turn to call. You make me scream and scream that I love you. When you make
what you want, I want for you. And we can work together, baby, to see it.
I've never met him.
Okay.
I'm writing a song now about I have love. I have love and love keeps loving me no matter what. But I'm just grateful to be here to tell as much as I can of our story because it's about our people.
You also revisit some of the songs that you formed on the Iron Pot Cooker in Ancestor House. Another recording.
Yes.
Yes. Live at Joe's Pub. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have information about who was in the room with you musician-wise. Would you happen to remember who played with you there?
Yeah, Michael Omer is the keyboard. He's my musical conductor, who is a spiritual brother, marvelous to work with. Michael Wimberly was on trap drums, and he knows his business. He's been in every aspect of creating and presenting music.
Yes.
Then James Simmons was on hand drums. He played congas and bongos or whatever you needed. The bass player, Trevor Allen, who had that kind of energy that I needed. And when we're playing 6/8 and Tell It, and he's always there pushing it. Then there was Spaceman.
Oh, William. Spaceman Patterson.
Yes, he was there on guitar.
Okay.
Yeah, that was it. We had worked a while together. Not a very long time, not as much as with Linda and the other group, but it went very well. And April Silva produced that whole evening.
Oh, okay. Of Aquila Work songs. She's celebrating her 20th year now.
That's right. She knows how to put things together.
Now, by the way, you mentioned Michael Omer. Is that James Blunt Omer's son?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's him.
There's one selection that you have on the Ancestor House recording, Elders.
Yes.
I'm going to open the program with that one.
Really?
Yes.
Good.
Where did that story come
from? It came from that song in particular. I'd been in New York for some time, and I was at that little studio apartment. After I'd had that experience when I went to East St. Louis in the class and was taken down and put down on the floor to teach me a lesson, to show me which way I was supposed to go, and I had things to do, and that I was somebody else other than who I thought I was. And then followed by the event when I was on the stage, I could not control what I was doing, and I wanted to speak to the audience, not from the script.
In
and the
play.
Producer almost fired me.
Right.
I decided I had to pay more attention to that part of me that kept coming up. And so I called my mother and I called my father and I said, tell me about who we are. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about your growing up. And my father gave me so much information, and my mother, really, because she was a writer at heart, and she gave me information about her family. And I felt so grateful. And I had not, after all those years, I wanted to say thank you to them. And I thought of all of our elders who we see. I was even looking at John Henry Clark walking down the street, staggering. Elders, we see you walking down the street with work-worn hands and weary feet. We hear your wisdom lift a child from confusion up to standing proud. You carried us. You still inspire, lifting us higher, higher, higher. And every time we think of what you've come through, elders, we're so proud of you. It goes on. I wrote it as a poem. I may not have quoted it correctly just now. And I called my mother and read it to her, and she was just pleased because we don't tell our elders enough.
That's right.
Thank you for what they have experienced. They brought us here. That's what I was saying the other night. The young people, they don't know the world we lived in, and they don't understand it when we tell them certain things. So we who have done it, we who have lived through it, have to make it clear how we survived. And they are why we survive. When I see our young people now who are not attached to the culture, have not been informed by the Greek culture, it hurts. It's painful. Sometimes just walking in the street, it is painful. Because when you don't know who you are, you will try and be anybody.
This is true. And you were talking about the event the other night. It was something that Bob Law had presented at the Mist Theater, exploring the real power and influence of black music today.
Absolutely. And I so proud of seeing Lenora Sharpe grow in the culture. That she was there was very important.
Yes, she was on the panel. For those who aren't aware, Sister Lenora Sharpe is a young lady who her grandmother would bring her to varying events in the communities. And we've seen her growing up. We've seen her since she was a very small child. Her mind is definitely centered. She knows exactly who she
is. That's right.
As a result of that.
And that's what we have to do. We cannot make progress, those who have been here for some time, without our children, and we have to inform them about who they are. And it's difficult because this society says what we used to be is not worth anything, and that family attachments are changing now. We just have to go along to get along. That's not true. The values which had us survive, you can go back into the spirituals and hear the people talking about the same thing, about honoring and lifting up higher. And when they had no shoes, they knew they were going to get some shoes now. When they were raggedy, they knew they were going to get some robes because they were visionary. We are visionary people. And so this is what we have to repeat and let our young people know. And then the poets used to come from the community. Now they come from someplace else. Their suits make them. Oscar Brown Jr., who wrote magnificent work.
From Chicago.
I knew him before he became Oscar Brown, and I was still studying. I was dancing after school when I first met him. But all of our great teachers who were musicians and artists, many of them lost their professions, lost their lives, some of them, because of upholding our art. And our art was school. There's a book I have, 100 Years in Show Business, written by this brother who came up shortly after enslavement ended. And he talks about being in show business. It's amazing, the lessons that are in there about performance.
I think that book you're talking about is 100 Years of the Negro in Show Business, the Tom Fletcher story. Could that be it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. And when I was in high school, I would go to the Chicago Theater. I was working after school, and I would go to the theater and just watch our great artists on the stage and how they presented themselves. They were funny, but they were dignified. They had class. They used to say, plant yourself when you go on stage. What do you mean, plant yourself? First, you don't run all over the stage, because it depends on what your function is. If your function is to tell your story and share with the people, you have to reach them first. And there's techniques of going on the stage and planting yourself until you have them. And then you begin to move and do other things. And your whole relationship with your audience came out of experience of how to work an audience. Patti LaBelle does it. It's not something that's unique. It still works right now. And now we have light shows. You go to any, all these thousands of lights. How can you focus? It's done intentionally because our people are not talking about, many of ours, not talking about anything that is really relevant to us on a deep level.
You mentioned Nina Simone earlier, and you had participated in a documentary by the British vocalist, Laura Mvula, focusing on her connection to Nina Simone. Do you want to tell me about how that came about and what you took away from it?
Actually, it was Nina's brother.
Oh.
They did research. Before they came over and did this, they looked up
Samuel Wayman.
That's right. And it was he who told them about my connection. I believe that's how it happened. Because they called me and said that Mvula was coming here. And she wanted to attach herself to the dignity and the power of Nina Simone and the commitment that she showed in her music. And I said, that's a good idea. It was just a small piece. BBC came to this apartment with all the books and papers and stuff. And there had been a fire, so their mobility was limited. But she can sing.
Yes, she can.
I've heard her on other places, and she tears the house down.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting experience. People have attached themselves to the spirit of Nina Simone, and especially Europeans have tried to take the quality of her voice, but that doesn't work. I had conversations with Miss Simone, Nina, in her apartment. I have traveled with her to Chicago when she did my song, Ain't It a Lonely Feeling, being just I and me instead of we and free. and seen her at times when she goes through what other artists go through. And it's just like Michael Jackson being criticized for sitting in a tree, being part of nature. So people will be critical of that. But mm-hmm. I do know that I was very honored when I was at, I think it was called Aaron Davis Hall, and I sat there and heard her do two of my songs. She did pieces of All Hid, and that's strictly political. It was a great experience, and I'm honored to have been associated with her in that way.
In the scene that is included in BBC documentary, you were talking about Nina Simone's song, Four Women.
Yes.
And the usage mm-hmm. of the term aunt and auntie. Could you expound on that? Because people are starting to use that these days, and it's as though they aren't aware of the origin of that.
Well, again, so much comes from the South, the time of when our people were enslaved. And many of us were very close to those families that enslaved us. As a means sometimes of showing some respect, they would refer to some black person as Auntie so-and-so. This is my understanding of it. As a matter of fact, there were greeting cards from Auntie so-and-so, and it wasn't from our family. It was from some white people who had formerly supposedly owned us. An uncle, like Uncle Remus.
Right.
You understand?
Exactly.
It's giving a little respect, but not real, because it wasn't real.
Because these days I hear people walking around calling the congressperson, Maxine Waters, Auntie Maxine, and it makes me cringe every time I hear it. And I understand they mean it as a term of endearment. This is what kicks in for me, that history uh-huh. that is attached to that usage. It's like,
yes.
No, but that doesn't make it okay. She's a fully grown woman. Give her the respect. And if you really want to respect her, call her Congresswoman.
There you go. And keep saying it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's familiar. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And it's like there was a period when if there was a story about us in the newspaper, they would always call us by our first names. Mm. It was never Mrs. So-and-so or wow. Mr. So-and-so. It was Mary so-and-so. And Walter White, who was an activist, he also worked with the NAACP, pushed people and pushed the New York Times and all these paper people to address us as Mrs. or Mr. So-and-so. That first name thing was intrusive and invasive. It was put on us because they thought that they would not respect us as they respected everybody else. Now, when the movement, we had pushed them to give us Mrs. and Mr. In the 60s and 70s, when we were pushing, no, you have to hire us at these different places. On Wall Street, you have to hire us. As a matter of fact, Woolworths was not hiring any black folks. All of these companies which were not hiring us, and then we went to war with them, and we marched, and we went to court, and we won some cases, and they said, okay, we'll hire Mrs. So-and-so and Mr. So-and-so. And then the whole new attitude came up. When you're in the office, we're going to go on a first name basis. So they started this first name basis thing because they did not want to call us Mr. or Mrs. So when we look at each other now and we come into an office and we put a little sign on our chest, I am Mary, or I'm, that's what that is all about.
Wow.
At the bottom of them is racism.
Right.
That still becomes second nature.
You participated in another film with brother Victorious Da Costa. He's doing a film on Weldon Irvine.
Yes, he is. I knew Weldon. Mm. I respected Weldon so much. We had good conversations. I saw his heartbreak at the way he was not accepted, or the things he would say, or the respect he gave to his work and mm-hmm. to people and to us. I had more discussion with him than anything else. When I wanted to do the album Ancestor House, I first thought about him, and I asked him if he would help produce it for me. And then things happened, and I got caught up in other things. Next thing I know, he had passed. But he was a marvelous musician and a very respectful and good person.
Did you know him when he was working with Nina Simone?
Yes, I did.
Okay. They co-wrote Young, Gifted, and Black Man.
That's right. They did. His association with Nina was invaluable, and working on that song was so important.
You have many mentors, but I remember hearing Josephine Baker standing out. In what
Absolutely.
Way was she a mentor?
Again, you must take yourself, if you can, into the late 40s, 50s. I think she first came back over here in around 51. But America was very different, especially for us. And on the south side of Chicago, as they say, it was redlined. It was a bucket of blood. That's the way they referred to the south side of Chicago, as too many locations where black people were restricted. And within those restrictions are people, women especially, coming home from work as maids and cooks and in menial jobs for the most part at that time. Our men did not have all of this corporate employment. They were porters, worked at the stockyards, had a lot of times jobs that they were overqualified for. They were not allowed. I remember in a building there was a brother who was in the Army. He was a pilot, and yet he couldn't get work after the war. But he was trained even earlier than that, and he couldn't get work. It was a difficult period. And our artists, we were not wearing blackface anymore, but there was a pull. It was a period when we tried to speak out. We stood up and fought. There were those of us who were fighting and speaking about racism and how we had to get above it and we had to stop it. That was constant. But I remember when my sister's former fiancé, who worked, I think, at the post office, then he brought a brand new car. As a matter of fact, he had to show off, so he brought a white Cadillac. And he's on the south side of Chicago, and he was from Mississippi. And people said, "Don't you do that." And he rode all the way down to Mississippi in that car where he was shot because he was sitting in the car with his sister who was lighter than he was. Man, they saw him sitting in that car with this white woman and they shot him. And those things were happening. The police in the neighborhood were doing what they're doing now, only nobody talked about it. And there were a lot of black brothers and sisters who were doing things that they were trained to do, anti-cultural, social things. So it was a different head, but there was always that desire and that work at improving. And my father always said, do better. Don't just accept this. And he worked as hard as he could as a precinct captain, trying to change our thinking for the better. We always believed that we were better than we were being restricted to be at that time. Then suddenly, here comes this woman who didn't give a damn about racism. She came and she was on the stage and she dressed marvelously. She was funny, but she was dignified and she was glamour to the max. Talking about learning how to present yourself on the stage, just watching her was school. And believe me, I went to school often as I could just to watch that presentation. The others, too. I was at the Chicago Theater when Sarah Vaughan was introduced for the first time at the Chicago Theater, and eggs were thrown at her.
Oh, no.
Yeah, Dave Garraway was a broadcaster in Chicago.
Yes, he was the first Tonight Show host.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He introduced black people in the Chicago Theater. They had not been able to work there for years and years and years and years, not on a big scale, and he brought her on first. It was a difficult time, but Josephine Baker came up, and she talked about race on the stage. Mm-hmm. She told America, you're not treating black people properly, and that this racism has to stop. And she went across the country doing that. And when you're doing that, and you have this marvelous spirit, up there, and you're dressed a certain way, and you address the audience with respect and love, you're accepted. And it was so unique at that point. America just went up. White people and black people were amazed by this woman who had such courage. Well, she'd been to the race riots in East St. Louis where hundreds of our people were killed. That's how she got out of that city, running from the race riot. There was so much else that went on. But I admired her courage to speak truth. And she was put out of the country for doing it, accused of being a communist. And I said, I'm going to talk about our people. And she and Paul Robeson, who had done it before her, were people who I admired a great deal. And Paul Robeson, he was the one that Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier grew up under, learning from him. So we all learn from the great ones from before. We all have gifts. We are born with gifts. There's a gift that lives inside you. It keeps growing. Oh, that's a shadow from cornrows. When I say there's a spirit that lives inside you, it keeps growing. It never dies. Sometimes when you're afraid, your spirit trembles. Sometimes when you're hurt and ready to give up, it barely flickers, but it keeps growing. It never dies. That's how our spirit is. But you have to find it. Unfortunately, because of social pressures, racial pressures, we're looking for ourselves someplace else. And it's right here. It's in you. My guests were listening to people and watching and then trying to write things about them, which bring out the conflicts and the solutions. It's like when people are violent. for years. I used to watch my father, as a matter of fact, before he went off. I went to Mama and said, why is he like that? She told me his background, which was just full of violence. And I would see, before somebody wanted to do that, you'd see that fear in their eyes. It's like a flicker, but it's fear. And then out of that fear comes the anger. And I decided years ago I would not return the favor, because when someone does something negative to us, the tendency is to do it back. But that just continues the confusion. It continues the negativity. But I'll have to find a way to bring some light, bring some goodness to this situation. It's like looking at this hip-hop in Los Angeles, in Atlanta, where the sisters just go back and forth insulting one another. It's because they don't have the knowledge. If you have the greatness, if you see your greatness, you will not act petty. You will not get involved in all of the name-calling and the violence. As I say, an empty bell makes a lot of noise. You have to fill yourself with your culture, with who you are. We are so rich in it. I'm so honored. That's why it hurts so bad when I look around and I see us wasted. And I have to say this about the stage, too. Francis Cresswell says, we're the only people who call each other dogs and bitches and hoes. There's a reason why we do it, but we're kept so busy with the minutiae, with hype, and most of our show business, not theater necessarily, but performing artists, a lot of it is just hype, and they have captured hip-hop and made it loud noise up at the top. No bass drum playing, just the kinte. And it doesn't work that way. It has to have all of it together, but you have to have a bass, which is the culture. This is something that is hidden from our young people. So it's up to us to bring it to them. I don't know of enough of the other young people who are trying to, or who are, uplifting the culture. Some of them are in the church because they sing church music. But it's not going to end up in church. I was more affected by Ray Charles when he was not singing church songs.
Right.
You understand?
Right. Although he still used the culture in his songs.
Yes, he did. See, they use it the other way. You know, this is what Bob Lowe and sister friend of mine were talking about, the lyrics, which are so degrading, and yet the rhythm is there. And
right.
See, they're smart enough to use the rhythm
right.
to get you moving, and
right.
subconsciously you're saying the words.
Right.
So, but that's a trick. I hope there were more, and I think they're there, but they have to be informed, and they have to be associated with something that is deep and not just hype. Holla, everybody. Just raise your hands like you don't care. What the hell is that? Excuse me. But it came from, we came out of the movement where you talk to care. Raise your fist in the air like you care. And so they had to tear that down. We used to stand up when we really admired something. Now they got people standing for anything. It's all hype. What happened to soul? Can't nobody talking about soul, and that's what's missing.
Actually, speaking of soul, you were on the program Soul. What did you do when you
yes,
were on there?
Well, I did some poetry, but it comes out mad. But that poem, when I first did it on Soul, was only the first part of it. By the time I did it at Lincoln Center, when they had Soul at the center, at a time when Nina Simone came, and I didn't know she was there. That I closed the show, about 8 poets were there, and at the end of it, I had added, why are we going to fuss and fight on Monday? How are we going to not speak on Tuesday? How are we going to throw hot water on Wednesday? How are we going to cut up clothes on Thursday? How are we going to go upside the head on Friday? How are we going to kick ass on Saturday? And what's left over, how we got the nerve to carry it to Jesus to save on Sunday morning? When that happened, the house always went up. But it happened before that, when I started saying, I don't think no less of him because he can't find a job. I did it when they recorded it on Soul. I noticed that they cut that out. It was like they went quickly to the next thing.
Oh, wow.
And they should not have, because that was important. And the great Alice Childress was on Soul. I always give her respect. She was a great writer. She looked as if she was white, but she wasn't. And she wrote Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich.
Right.
She wrote a lot of good work. And I'd done one of her plays, Wine in the Wilderness, on the college campus. But when I went to do Soul, that's where I met her. Afterwards, she came and she said, I liked your work very much. Next thing I know, well, 6 months later, I get a letter from Coward McCann and Gehagan Publishers, and those were her publishers, and the letter said that Alice Childress had included my name in a list of names. The publisher had asked her for a list of younger writers, and she had given them a list of names, and my name was on there, and asked me to bring in some of my poetry. I did, and one of the poems was Cornrows. And he said, what are cornrows? And I sat there. That time my hair was cornrows.
Uh-huh.
I said, these are cornrows. And he said, can you make it a story coming from an 8-year-old child? And I said, yes, I can. I had never written a book at that time. But the song was already there. I had been doing the song for some time. So that's how the book Cornrows came about, through the great writer Alice Childress, who was a dear person who loved black people so much and who did all she could to help raise our position in this world. So I always like to give her props.
Well, Nana Camille Yarborough, thank you so much,
ma'am,
for spending all of this time with us on Sugar in My Bowl. Is there anything else you want to tell the listeners before we move on?
Just be true to our culture, true to our ancestry, true to yourself. Look out for my next song.
All right. That's
the
it.
The song is No Matter What. It's coming out. Thank you for doing what you're doing with this show. It's very important that we get our story across and present it in a respectable and entertaining way.
Thank you
so much.
Thank
you for playing those drums, too, girl. You play some bad drums. Shoot.
Thank you so much, Nana Kim.
But now a nation of people has crossed over, and they're looking for you to come to. Oh, it's such a lonely feeling, talking about my and me, instead of we and free.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening has been writer, actress, composer, and social commentator, essentially Jelly, Nana Camille Yarborough. What you're listening to in the background is Ain't It a Lonely Feeling from Camille Yarborough's The Iron Pot Cooker. Before that, we heard Take Your Praise from The Iron Pot Cooker. Before that, we heard Praise You from Fatboy Slim. That is the recording that had sampled Nana Camille Yarborough from his 1998 Skint Records release, You've Come a Long Way, Baby. And before that, you heard Family Forever from Camille Yarborough's The Iron Pot Cooker. Once again, that's Camille Yarborough, who is the writer and vocalist, Linda Twine on clavinet, Leopoldo Fleming on conga and percussion, James Benjamin on bass, and Jimmy Johnson on drums. And of course, before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Sugar in My Bowl is scheduled to return on August 5th. Stay tuned. La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
It's such a lovely feeling, being just family, instead of them and me. Oh, it's such a lovely feeling, being just family, instead of I and me. Ain't it a lovely feeling, being just we?
Hello? Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.